welcome to East Meets West. I'm Olga Bataman.
I'm Tara Reid.
Yeah, and so after doing our previous episode with probably the most famous journalist in the world, Tucker Carlson, we thought that it may be a good idea to give our viewers Russian perspective.
Exactly.
And invite a Russian official to discuss the major news and issues, what's going on in the world.
I agree.
So here we have with us today Konstantin Kosachev, who is Deputy Speaker of the Russian Federation Council. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for this invitation. Thank you for confidence and trust. I am probably not entitled to present the official Russian position. We have other more prominent people, but I am ready to give my explanation to what's going on and how people should treat it.
But maybe first of all, let's start with expressing our sincerest condolences to families who lost their beloved ones, their children, their family members in this Ukrainian attack on a very actually tiny guest house in Kirillovka. And for those of the viewers maybe who have not seen, it's really a tiny guest house with a chalet-shaped houses, a small swimming pool, playground for kids, nothing that could be used, you know, for military purposes. So 13 people were killed there, three kids among them. And also today, as you may know, Russia is commemorating the Day of Remembrance of Child Victims of the War in Donbass that was launched by Ukrainian regime. And on this day, we remember the 23-year-old young mother, Kristina Zhuk, who was killed in Gorlovka in a grad shilling, holding close her 10-month-old daughter, Kira, and she, now she's called the Gorlovka Madonna. She's a symbol of those innocent people, innocent kids who were just killed 12 years ago, when there was no special military operation. It was just a couple of months after the referendum, where 90% of voters in the Donetsk Republic and 96% of voters in the Luhansk Republic voted for their independence. And that's how they were treated by Ukrainian authorities.
Yeah. Our condolences, our sympathy with people who have been killed, who are suffering. For all of them who live in the area of the conflict. And when I look at the current developments, I have an idea that what's happening now inside of the Russian territories was happening exactly the same way during the first 8 years of the conflict, starting in 2014 and until the start of the special military operation. And Ukrainian military were shelling civil villages, cities, killing civilians. At that moment, citizens of Ukraine, by the way, because for them, already in the beginning, they did not belong to the real Ukraine. Ukraine was, starting from the coup d'etat in 2014, Ukraine was meant only for Ukrainians. Anybody else are to be suppressed or eliminated. If one would come back to the history of the so-called Bandera movement, he and his supporters, they were killing, they were assassinating not just Jews, Poles, Russians, they were assassinating Ukrainians as well. Those Ukrainians who did not share the same ideology, the ideology of Ukraine as an independent state for only clean and pure Ukrainians. And it continued in 8 years, and unfortunately, nobody else but only Russia reacted on that. We were trying to talk about that in the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, in the Parliamentary Assembly of the OSCE, in the United Nations, elsewhere. It was completely silent about what happened in Odessa in May 2014, right. What happened in these days on the 27th of July in Gorlovka. And they continue to keep silence on that today when people are being killed in Kirillovka. And this will unfortunately continue if we don't solve the problem of Ukrainian nationalism in power.
And by the way, on the 13th of August, also 12 years ago, as you may remember, in Zugres, there was an attack that they bombed, when Ukraine bombed a children's beach, just a beach on the lake where people were spending their leisure time with their kids. And again, it was like a beach equipped for safe swimming of the kids. Right. So they were bombed and 13 lives were taken away.
Because these people are not people, they're not human beings.
Humans.
For those who give these criminal orders. Mm-hmm. This is it. This is a problem. This is a huge problem with the regime which exists in Ukraine.
But we don't see any condemnation whatsoever.
Nothing.
From
no.
any Western community, neither from European countries nor from the US
or even the UN, really.
Yeah, there is no condemnation whatsoever. We didn't see it 12 years ago. Mm-mm. We don't see it now.
And I was going to ask you about just the terrorism itself. You're seeing Israel participate in Gaza and commit a genocide, basically. And you're seeing the way the U.S. just victimized children in Iran. They targeted children. And now you see Ukraine doing it. And the U.S. and NATO is supplying Ukraine with weapons, with Starlink, with all of the things they need to continue these atrocities. Do you feel like there is a trend where international law just isn't applying, where civilians just aren't being protected in the rules of war, so to speak?
Unfortunately, this is a major problem, that the international law does not exist any longer, at least in the interpretations of those stronger nations and stronger countries, which do not need international law because it makes them equal to minor actors on the international arena. They don't need it. They want to be as strong as possible. They want to rule the world. It's not a propaganda campaign. They want to rule the world. Mm-hmm. And this is why they invent this rules-based order. You would remember the classical Animal Farm by George Orwell. Mm-hmm. First, there were some distant rules, but later on, they were somehow amended, mm-hmm. and nobody knew how they were amended, mm-hmm. and suddenly it was a completely opposite sense in these mm-hmm. rules. This is what happens with the rules-based order. You cannot intervene a country which is independent in one case, and this is about Russia being now inside of Ukraine, but you can kidnap presidents of sovereign countries, like in Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
You can
them.
Bomb Iran, mm-hmm. Accusing Iran for what Iran has not done and was not planning to do mm-hmm. any time. So this is the major problem of the current world order, rules-based order, replacing the international law.
Konstantin Osipovich, but do you think United States has any control of Ukraine, any control of what Ukraine is doing? Because just recently we've heard from Marco Rubio saying that Anchorage agreements failed. But we all remember that mm-hmm. that was just a package brought by the United States to the table. That's what Russia looked into and agreed upon made some concessions, it was ready to compromise something to reach a peaceful agreement. And then a year later, they said that the agreement has failed. So it means that they cannot control Ukraine. They have not control whatsoever. What do you think of that? What happened?
I do not want to make any comparisons, historical comparisons. But when I think about the current foreign policy of the United States of America, I can't help remembering the famous approach introduced by, at that moment, Senator Harry Truman 1 month after the Great Patriotic War started in July 41 or something like that, I believe, when he said, we'll see, and if Germans start to win over Russians, we will support Russians. If Russians will start to win over Germans, we will start to support Germans and let them kill each other as mm-hmm. much as possible. Again, no comparisons, but this is how it looked like, and this is how it continues mm-hmm. to look like, at least to me, because in my mind, the conflict in Ukraine for the current administration in the United States or for any administration mm-hmm. in the United States does have a certain domestic
dimension. So mm-hmm.
Yes, we remember the promise of Donald Trump to settle the conflict in one
yes.
day.
Yeah.
And we
yeah.
do understand the ambition of Donald Trump to settle the 9th or the 19th war in his political career. But this is for the domestic usage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In terms of what's going on internationally around this conflict between Russia and Ukraine, the United States of America does not suffer, mm-hmm. frankly speaking.
No.
Europe does.
Yes.
But the United States of America doesn't.
Right.
I don't know whether Americans earn money on that or not. Probably they do.
They do, but, of course.
but they're
collecting from all of the NATO members and calling for more and more
exactly.
money.
Exactly. So they will be ready to mediate, to assist to a possible solution if it is reachable, if it is easy to get there, so to say. And I believe in Anchorage, they were sincere to believe that, of course, it is quite close and one has to put certain pressure on Ukrainians and it will be done. And later on, they discovered that first, it is not that easy to set pressure on Ukrainians. Yes, they do not control Ukrainians the way they would like to control
them.
So
they do not control the country they are funding, they're sponsoring.
Yes, they do not control it, unfortunately. And this is how the development of the situation goes beyond the control of the mm-hmm. Americans and other nations supporting Ukraine.
Well, wait a second, though. But BlackRock owns part of Ukraine now. So my question is about BlackRock and the motives. Of course, there's the map, right? There's the geographical. That's why America and NATO are up against that border, right? That's the controversy there. But also, there's minerals, right? And there's land. So what role does it play for Ukraine? And secondarily, you have a president that's illegitimate. Zelensky's illegitimate, right? So how do you get to peace and get a legal peace agreement if some of the land is actually owned by a U.S. company called BlackRock, or an international company, I should say, Israel?
It is a really difficult question for me, because we would have preferred to have deals with a sovereign state of Ukraine.
Right.
It is not sovereign any longer, mm-hmm. not at all. We have BlackRock, we have Americans, we have many European interests inside, we have many advisors mm-hmm. coming from Brussels, from mm-hmm. NATO, from the European Union, from elsewhere. So we cannot, frankly speaking, we cannot reach to Ukrainians. We cannot reach to the Ukrainian people because the Ukrainian people is so much suppressed. There is mm-hmm. no freedoms, there is no democracy, there is no rule of law, there is no protection of civil rights, nothing of that kind. So the people of Ukraine cannot solve the problem of the government, how the country will be governed. Mm-hmm. It is decided somewhere else, but not inside of Ukraine. And for us, it is not possible to talk to Ukrainians. They don't want to talk to us. They have prohibited by law, by presidential decrees, to have any negotiations with Russians. And they are trapped. In my mind, the current leaders of Ukraine, they are trapped. They cannot make deals with Russia without going out and either being criminally punished mm-hmm. Or sensed, or just disappearing in terms of big politics, so to say. This is a problem. Problem number two is, of course, Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Europe is a huge problem. And I believe if you allow me to take some time. I believe that Europeans are also trapped, mm-hmm. definitely, by at least five huge mistakes, miscalculations they have done since 2014. Number one was a completely false interpretation of the events during the Maidan revolution. Mm-hmm. Because people in Europe immediately declared that these events were a democratic revolution. People were tired of a totalitarian leader. They wanted to get rid of this leader. And that was a pure democratic revolution to be supported. Not at all. That was a completely false interpretation because it was a coup d'etat, no mm-hmm. doubt about that. Yep. But it was about one certain political force with a certain political platform, program, coming into power with force. And the political program of that political force was, again, Ukraine for Ukrainians. Not Ukraine for everybody living in Ukraine or being citizens of Ukraine, but Ukraine for ethnic Ukrainians, mm-hmm. like Bandera used to put it.
And as we'll remember, those speaking Russian should send their kids to
and
the basement.
Bandera was immediately declared as the national hero of Ukraine. That was first huge mistake, and they cannot get out of this trap. Mm-hmm. Number two was to interpret the change of the status of Crimea as a Russian occupation. Mm-hmm. Not at all. Not we were there in order to let people self-determine themselves. Mm-hmm. This is it. No people were killed, no army was used, nothing. Mm-hmm. It was a free choice of people living in Crimea, mm-hmm. not an occupation. Number three was about the faith of the Minsk agreements. Mm-hmm. Again, it was a unique chance for Ukraine to keep its territorial integrity, of course, without Crimea, without Sevastopol, but with Donbas, with all the areas which are now being disputed, to put it mildly. It was a unique chance supported by Russia. I know for sure that at that moment in 2014, in 2015, when the Minsk agreements mm-hmm. Had been worked out, people living in the southeastern part of Ukraine were strongly against this agreement, strongly against. They were opposing it by all their hearts and minds and everything. We, Russians, Russia, convinced them to agree to live inside of Ukraine under certain conditions.
Yeah, if they were provided down, certain rights.
Exactly.
If they were allowed to speak
put down
their language.
In the Minsk agreement. So mm-hmm. it was a unique chance for Ukraine to keep its territorial integrity. Mm-hmm. And everybody started to blame Russia for not living up to the commitments in the Minsk agreements without discussing the sabotage of the Minsk agreements from Kyiv. Nothing. Number four was to ignore the Russian proposals in December 2021. You remember the package to discuss in complexity the European security relations with NATO, relations with Ukraine, security arrangements, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. It was put on the table in written format to be discussed. It was ignored. It was ignored. By the way, the same thing happened in, let me remember, in June 2008, 3 months before the Georgian crisis. Mm-hmm. That was the first time, 3 months before the Georgian crisis, we proposed a package of our proposals on common European security. It was ignored, and then Saakashvili attacked Tskhinval and South Ossetia. Same thing, 3 months before the start of this special military operation, we had this proposal in order to avoid the worst case scenario. Yes, that was the fourth mistake. And the fifth one, the last one, probably the biggest one, was to undermine the Istanbul process. Mm, Istanbul right. process. March and April 2022 were extremely important, and we were ready to freeze the conflict. We were ready mm-hmm. to make agreements, and Ukrainians were ready to make agreements. And now when Mr. Takayev goes and proposes to Mr. Putin to go back to Istanbul process. For me, it sounds a little bit strange because it was not us, Russians, getting out of the Istanbul process. It was Ukrainians, and they were strongly supported by the Europeans, Boris Johnson, people like him. So if Mr. Tokayev or anybody else who wants to assist the peaceful process, the solution of the conflict, I believe each of them should go not to Russia, not to Mr. Putin. They should go to Kyiv, and they should go to European capitals who now are strongly against any negotiations. So these five mistakes, for me, lock any possibilities for the European countries to practice a more flexible approach, so to say. The Americans do have this possibility because Mr. Trump happily has Mr. Biden. He may blame Biden for everything. Yes, but Mr. Macron does not have this opportunity.
Right.
Mr. Merz does not have this opportunity because he continues the same politics. And none of the new British prime ministers have this opportunity to blame the predecessors because they have exactly the same approach, exactly the same politics in the Ukrainian conflict.
Konstantin Vasilyevich, but since you mentioned Trump, what Trump is doing now, what we're hearing from him recently, he's calling for the introduction of new sanctions against Russia in the honor of Senator Lindsey Graham, who passed away not long ago and who was very quickly replaced by his sister as a marionette, so to say, because the money should stay with the firm, you know. So they quickly replaced him with his sister. So he's calling for the introduction of new sanctions against Russia. They're also promised at the recent NATO summit in Ankara. They promised to transfer a license for Patriot production to Ukraine. So all of those steps. So I think they're aimed at putting pressure at Russia. But can you make Russia more inclined for any concessions if you put more pressure on that? Or I guess Russia would be only less inclined, you know, to make any concessions.
Two answers. Number one, we have certain experiences about Mr. Trump. And we know that sometimes he declares certain plans and intentions, and later on he changes his ambitions quite easily, with all my respect to Mr. Trump. So I believe we should not react that seriously on what he declares.
You used
the word steps. It is not about steps yet. It's about intentions
declarations.
Exactly, declarations. So we'll see what will happen in practice. This is number one, and this is my first answer. My second answer, whatsoever happens in practice will not make any effect on Russia. We are in the fifth year of the special military operation. We are in the second part of the second decade of sanctions imposed on Russia, and we are still alive, we are still going strong. I believe we
are kicking really well, I guess.
yes, of course it creates certain problems for us, no doubt about that, but the major conclusion is that it is not possible to isolate Russia. It is not possible to tear Russian economy into, what was that?
Pieces,
okay, yes. It is not possible to contain Russia. It is not possible to frighten Russia. We will continue either with the assistance of the United States of America or without any assistance from the United States of America, but we will continue to solve the problems which initiated this special military operation, and there are two major problems. One is protection of people
who
are native to us, who are civil people. And number two is about the Russian national security, no doubt about that, NATO expansion and deployment of really offensive military forces along the Russian border is something which we cannot afford and which we will never accept.
And denazification as well, because I guess that's what most Westerners, or at least in the United States, they don't realize, because for them, this war, I mean, the Great Patriotic War, the Second World War, was something, you know, far away. But Russians, There is not a single family who wouldn't have lost family members, male family members. In my family, all of the male population above the age of 17 was just
almost
exterminated.
Almost same here.
Yeah, so
same here.
Those who survived were only like 4 years old toddlers. So for us, I mean, it's not just a memory. It's this beast of fascism. We see it's raising its head. For us, it's not a joke. We already went through that. We suffered for it, we died for it.
Fortunately, there are countries who were strongly affected by Nazism in the past who now react on what's going on in Ukraine. Israel does react, and Poland.
Poland.
Both react. But countries who were a little bit far away from the happenings during the Second World War, they unfortunately do not understand really what this is about. And they can live with Ukraine, glorifying Bandera, glorifying Melnik or Konovalets and other people who are pure Nazis. They are pure Nazis, but they are national heroes of Ukraine. And people in the Netherlands or, I do not know, in Portugal believe, okay, they are their national heroes, so what? Let them have their national heroes, we will have our national heroes. This is much, much more serious, and we cannot afford happening this again. We cannot afford another Nazi Germany being now replaced by Nazi Ukraine. Mm-hmm.
Going back to the sanctions, the U.S. has been using sanctions rather than a diplomatic tool. They use it as a weapon, so it's a diplomatic weapon, and it doesn't lead to very much diplomacy. But Russia has turned inward, and I would say I came here in 2023. Russia's doing very well. I've been to the U.S. The U.S. economically, and what you're not hearing in the mainstream media in the West, people are suffering. There's the highest amount of child poverty in the U.S. that's in history in this moment, that started with Biden's administration and now continues with Trump. Trump kept none of his promises. He has betrayed all his voters. All the things he said he was going to do, he has not done. So that was a conversation we had with Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson feels so strongly about it. He left the Republican Party and has renounced Trump.
Yes.
So he feels very strongly. Trump made a lot of promises to Russia and made a lot of very, you know, very flowery statements about President Putin and so on. But how does Russia feel about Trump? Because I've kind of been of the ilk, like he talks a lot, but his actions speak something else. And I don't think he has much power anyway. I think he's controlled by Israel. I think our country is gone. The sovereignty is lost. It was lost last week. We voted to merge the Israel army with the U.S. army, which has never happened in history, and it's treason, and it's done. And now you can't undo that because they didn't just merge the military. They merged the intelligence. Mm-hmm. So now it's a mandate for U.S. to share intelligence with Israel, which is unheard of. So anyway, bottom line, Trump betrayed the American voters by in the opinion of many Americans. How does Russia feel?
Well, maybe I will make you disappointed as an originally American.
Okay.
But frankly speaking, I don't think that many people in Russia care much about Mr. Trump. It is not him who determines our life.
Right.
It is not him who determines the way the conflict with Ukraine continues. It's only us Russians. Of course, we will be happy to see Mr. Trump going into details and starting to understand better what's going on in Ukraine and around Ukraine, what's going on in Russia and around Russia. Of course, it could have assisted, but if it is not, it does not happen, so what? We will continue what we believe is important for us. We will continue to do what is good for us. And by the way, you started with sanctions.
Yeah.
You should go and talk to our people working in the agricultural sector. They are so happy
more
that
than
Russia
happy,
is sanctioned.
Yeah, more, than happy.
More and more. I do not try to be too much optimistic, but I believe that more and more branches of the Russian industry and agriculture start getting advantages out of this sanction policy against Russia. You know, mm-hmm. once, if we have two minutes, once I came to Cuba, it was 20 years ago, mm-hmm. and we started to discuss Russian-Cuban relations, and suddenly I heard again and again a word combination, a second blockade. Mm-hmm. Okay, what is it? The first blockade is the United States policy against Cuba since the Cuban Revolution. What's the second blockade? And the Cubans explained to me that we call the period when the Soviet Union collapsed and Russia just left Cuba alone as a second blockade. The people were starving. Yeah. We could not do anything because we were so much dependent on the assistance coming from the Soviet Union. And now comes the wisdom, so to say. The major conclusion this Cuban guy kept explaining to me, the major conclusion was that before it all happened, the second blockade, we were all convinced that we have no chance to survive without the Soviet Union, without the assistance from abroad. Mm-hmm. And when it happened, somehow we started to survive and we started to understand that we are capable mm-hmm. for something, that we are a nation which is capable. And that was the major conclusion. We are happy about our relations with Russia. We are still friends, but we are not the same people we were during the Soviet time. Mm-hmm. So for me, what happened to Russia now is approximately the same. We were so much convinced that we will not survive with the assistance from the West, with the Western technologies, with mm-hmm. the cooperation on everything possible, with import of agricultural production, all this stuff. Suddenly now we understand better that we are capable. And this is the major conclusion. And as a Russian, I'm very happy to see that happening. With all my respect to Mr. Trump.
I agree because I've seen it like in the grocery stores, wherever you go, buying cosmetics, you know, I get beautiful cosmetics from Russia. And what I'm noticing is that people are developing products here in Russia, and it's a really exciting time. And one more thing, and then the ruble is one of the strongest currencies in the world. So their plan kind of failed, didn't
and
it?
We started with cosmetics and cheese, probably. Now it's about airplanes. It's about airplanes and other very high technological projects. It's good.
Konstantin Osipovich, I wanted to ask you about, first of all, again, getting back to the Ankara NATO summit that proclaimed Russia the biggest long-term threat to NATO countries. And also about these rumors circulating in European media about Russia preparing for the invasion into Poland or like one of the Baltic states. Mm. Why are they doing it, as for you? I mean, as you've already rightly pointed out, even before the special military operation, we had four rounds of negotiations 3 months in advance, you know? So Russia was bringing its position on a number of occasions in all of the European, you know, big political capitals, so to say. So why are they spreading these rumors as of now?
I have only one explanation, and this is they want to keep NATO alive. They need to have an enemy. During the years of detente, during the 90s, NATO almost collapsed because we were friends. Russia was friends with NATO and other countries were friends with NATO. And NATO lost any sense of existing.
Any purpose of existing,
exactly. And suddenly they discovered that Russia is a good enough enemy. One can continue to be united and to get strength out of it by demonizing Russia. Number one, Russia is the biggest country in the world in terms of territory. We do not need land. We do not need any territories. And we are in Ukraine, not for territories. No doubt about that. We are there for people.
For the people.
But in the West, they believe that we are trying to restore an empire, and mm-hmm. for that we need territories. And this is how we want to to attack the Baltic states or Poland or any other European country. It's a complete lie. It's a complete falsification of real Russia, so to say. As soon as we feel ourselves secured, as soon as we feel that we are capable to protect our people, as soon as we feel that no Nazi Ukraine, no other country which wants Russian territories, which wants Russian natural resources, is coming closer to Russia, everything is very easy to settle. And this is why we propose this package solutions on the European security, which are completely acceptable, which are not at all discriminative towards any European country. And one has to listen to Russia. One has to come to Russia as often, as frequently as it is possible. And one has to talk to us Russians in order to understand that Russians do not want to have any wars at all. We've had enough wars, and most of them came from the Western side.
Yeah, it was not Russia that initiated, you know, so many wars as the country across the ocean. But if I may, I cannot help asking you about Hungary, because just recently, Minister of Defense of Hungary announced that Hungary was, as he put it, shutting the door on Russia. And Russia is building, first of all, Russia is building the Paks to nuclear power plant in Hungary. Mm-hmm. Hungary is, from what I know, 55% of all of the gas Hungary is consuming is coming from Russia. So, like, okay, guys, how can you shut the door on us? What do you think of it?
We've had this very unique experience of cooperation between Russia and the previous government of Hungary. Mm-hmm. It worked perfectly well.
Yeah.
It worked perfectly well. So Hungary is a very good and polite partner for Russia and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So problems are not on our side. If Hungary wants to start demonizing Russia the way other European countries do, it will be their choice. Hopefully the statement by the Minister of Defense, it's not the last statement we will hear from Budapest. But on this example, I want to give you another, I think, very good idea. Now we have a completely different relations between Russia on one side, mm-hmm. Belarus on the other side, and Ukraine on the other side. Mm-hmm. Completely different. Russia is the same. Mm-hmm. So the difference does not depend on Russia. It depends on countries which treat Russia this or that way. And when people start frightening our neighbors that if you come too closely to Russia, you will be immediately swallowed, suppressed, included into the Russian Empire, check relations between Russia and Belarus. Check relations between Russia and Kazakhstan. They are absolutely equal. Sometimes we see problems, sometimes it starts to get hot, but this is because these relations are completely equal. Mutual respect, understanding of national interests from each side, and same format, same model. We are ready to practice with any country which is ready to practice that model with us. Either Hungary or Poland or the Baltic states. Strange enough. It sounds strange right now, but again, our very bad relations with the Baltic states, with Poland, but many other European countries, do not depend on Russia.
It's not our fault.
It's not our fault, and it is not our choice. And we will be ready to normalize our relations as soon as we will start seeing the same approach, the same intention from the other side.
I wanted to ask you about something domestic, because our audience is a lot of Westerners, Americans and Europeans, that really have a skewed vision of Russia. They kind of have it frozen in the 1990s. And I've been trying to educate people that it's a capitalistic country, it's beautiful. And when we had Tucker on, he actually said this is his favorite country. He was just, it's incredibly beautiful, and it is. every place I go, Vladivostok, Sochi, St. Petersburg, I'm always like, I want to live here. You know, it's just beautiful. So you have all this beauty. But another thing is the young people are able to purchase homes. They're able to start businesses. In the United States, like my daughter is of that age after college. She and her husband are just struggling. They both have really good full-time jobs. They can't buy a house. They can't whatever. Here in Russia, 80% of Muscovites own their own flat. And many of them are young people. It's very within reach. What other domestic innovations and things are coming up for Russian citizens and, you know, kind of educate American and Westerners about what its life is like here?
Well, to disappoint you a little bit more for the second time, Moscow is not about the whole Russia. Moscow is not about the whole Russia. And of course, we do have problems in many regions of Russia.
Right.
And I believe that the major problem probably for the rest of Russia is an ongoing depopulation, because we have very big demographic problems. I am sorry to put it that frankly, but we have...
You need more babies.
Yes, yes, we have demographic problems. The birth rate index in Russia is now 1.3. Mm-hmm. In order to keep the number of people in a country on the same level, you need at least 2.1. Mm-hmm. 2.1, now we have 1.3. This is a huge problem, and in many cases, people do not want to live in the province. They want to move to the big cities, and youngsters want to get better education, better social conditions, theaters, and all that stuff. So this is a problem. This is a problem. I am absolutely frank with you.
Okay.
But on the other hand, to tell you more, we have fantastic youngsters who really love Russia, who are proud of Russia, who know the history of Russia, who are proud of their grandfathers and grand-grandfathers who won the Second World War over the Nazi Germany and its allies. And I believe that we have the coming generation which still or all the time has confidence and trust in the future life in Russia. There are so few people who want to immigrate. There are so few people who want to live somewhere else. And they have, I know for sure that we have many people now who immigrated after the beginning of the special military operation, who want to come back to Russia. I have so many letters from compatriots,
there
so to
so
say,
much
who live abroad. They seek opportunities to come back to Russia. And this is, for me, the major indication that we are on the right track in Russia.
You are.
And just a final, maybe like wrapping up question for me to address the foreign audience. If you were to formulate, like in very simple terms, the core principle of Russian foreign policy for our viewers, so that everyone can understand it, any average viewers, how would you formulate it?
One should open the UN Charter and start reading it from the first and the second articles. All nations and states are equal, and each nation should have national interests to be respected by others. I simplify the wording of the Charter, but this is it. And this is, to simplify things, is the core content of the Russian foreign policy, to live up with the content, with the principles, with the ideas, with the moral of the United Nations Charter. You don't need to invent anything else. You don't need any rules-based order. Go back to the United Nations Charter and let's live in peace and undivided security.
Thank you. Thank you for being with us.
Yes, thank you so much. It was really a wonderful talk.
And thank you. And for our viewers, please stay in touch with us. We'll try to bring more exciting guests.
Yes, thank you, please. And keep subscribing on our YouTube and on X, and send your questions and concerns. We are getting your messages, and we try to answer when we can.
Take care.
Take care.